Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I've got a friend of mine that is a beautician. She runs her own clinic, and she frequently has to turn away teenagers, like young girls, you know, kind of 13, 14, because they've come because they want to be fully waxed.
Wow.
Because they're saying it's not natural, and they don't know what to do about it. And they're very distressed, and she has to kind of take them aside and kind of explain that actually, you know, pubic hair is normal and it's okay. And then they're kind of saying, well, no, boys wouldn't want to sleep with me.
Right.
And it's kind of a part of a much more complex kind of sociocultural situation.
Absolutely.
So I kind of wanted in a very small way to kind of be like sort of celebrating people's bodies.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupia, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. And today we're talking about the importance of teaching children about health with Dr. Max Pemberton. Now, he's written a children's body, mind and anatomy guide for children. It's absolutely amazing and it's beautifully illustrated. Dr. Max, if you don't know, is a writer, mental health doctor and journalist. He's written three books, including one that I read when I was a junior doctor called Trust Me, I'm a Junior Doctor. I read this about 10 years ago when I started working at Basildon Hospital, and it was amazing. It really, really did resonate with me at the time, obviously. In his second book, Where Does It Hurt?, he details his experiences of working in an outreach project for the homeless and people addicted to drugs. Now, this new book explores the idea of children being aware of looking after themselves through food and nutrition. So obviously something after my own heart, and understanding the human body and how parents can facilitate that growth. Today we chat about his experiences of transitioning from adult to children's literary projects, his working eating disorders, why health messages, particularly over social media, are important to convey, and the messages to convey to children, but also how that inadvertently teaches parents as well. I cooked a taco recipe for Dr. Max, and you can check that out on YouTube. And you can find all of this information at more at The Doctor's Kitchen. You can find all of this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com. Subscribe to the newsletter for weekly science-based recipes and listen to the end of the pod for a summary of our discussion. On to the pod.
Tell me about your cooking habits.
I'm so embarrassed about this
now.
I just thought I'd come and you just make me food and then that'd be it. We would not talk about food. I don't know why I thought
that. I'm not going to interrogate you, don't worry. No judgment.
So my cooking habits, I would say, are probably not very good.
Okay.
In that I don't really do cooking.
Yeah.
So I've got a microwave and I'm quite adept. I'm not even very adept at the microwave, if I'm honest. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think it's because I love raw vegetables.
Uh-huh.
So every evening, I go back and I always go shopping, buy loads and loads and loads of vegetables, chop it all up.
Okay.
And then I'll just sit there with a massive bowl. And when I'm kind of writing, I just sort of sit there. Rather than sort of eating junky food or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
I just sit with vegetables. And I probably eat maybe 8-10 portions of vegetables.
Okay.
So like in a day.
Okay.
And then,
wow, that's a lot of veg, mate. You're doing really well.
It takes me all evening. I'll just sit there. But you know, you have like three peppers and loads of celery and broccoli and this kind of stuff. And I really like that. It's really nice.
Uh-huh.
And then I tend to be very, very boring. So I'll eat just the same thing repeatedly.
So
I really like jack and potato and cheese.
Okay, yeah, good.
And then I'll microwave the jack and potato. Get them free. So they're frozen.
Yeah,
they're really good.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm selling you jack potatoes.
No, the thing is, I did a whole feature on new potatoes a few weeks ago, just to show people actually, you know, potatoes are very nutrient dense.
Yes, they're amazing. They're like, they're like the dietitians at work always talk about them being a whole food.
Yeah.
Because basically you can pretty much kind of just live on just potatoes if you really need
to. Yeah, I mean, a lot of societies have based their eating habits on potatoes. Yeah. You look at the Aztecs, you look at people in South America, and you know, you grow tubers everywhere.
Yeah.
So they're very whole foods.
So. Yeah, and I eat a lot of chicken breasts as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, and I've worked out how to do that.
Okay.
Which actually, no, that, honestly, that was quite a big thing. Because actually, chicken's much harder. You imagine it's really easy. It's actually really hard to get it to cook. It's because it tastes a bit like rubbery.
Yeah.
Or then it's like raw in a pan, it makes you really ill.
Exactly.
So you have to be very careful.
You need to use your oven, actually, the one that hasn't been opened. Because if you put chicken in oven, all you need to do is make sure the temperature is on the correct temperature.
Which is what?
Which is, depends on what you're cooking. So if you're cooking chicken thighs.
So it'd be breast. Always breast. Always eat
always breast. So I'd go 180 degrees centigrade if it's fan assisted. Or 200 if it's not fan assisted.
Okay.
Yours probably is fan assisted because it sounds like a nice shiny new one.
It is.
And you whack it in there for about 25 to 30 minutes and just check if the juices run clear.
Right.
And then you're good to go. But put a marinade on your chicken so you can buy them pre-made from supermarket.
Okay.
You look really confused. Come on. You just marinade. Go to the marinade section. Two things. Marinade section and then chicken breast section.
Yeah.
Put those together. Baking tray, oven, 25 minutes.
Okay.
And that'll be... And you bring them out and then you're good to go.
Okay,
cool.
I should probably do that. But then now I sold my flat and I'm going to keep my oven nice and like, never used.
A brand new kitchen. Could charge an extra for that. Okay, right. So before we get into what you're here for today with your amazing new book that I'm really excited to talk about, I'm going to be cooking you something. So you can just sit there, chill,
this
relax. Hopefully you like it. I know you don't eat, you don't like chili food, is that correct?
I've got not a very sophisticated palate.
It's
my jacket potato and cheese.
No, that's absolutely fine. So I'm going to be cooking you some tacos.
Okay.
So very simple food. We've got whole grain tacos here. This is actually blue corn, which I just think it looks wonderful. I mean, the smell is delicious as well. Mm. You can get white corn taco, absolutely fine. You can use whole grain wraps as well.
Where do you get those from? Just anywhere.
You can actually buy these online. These are really nice. Supermarkets are getting them in a bit more often now because, you know, the whole gluten-free trend, and these are completely gluten-free as well. So you'll see them in supermarkets, or you can buy them online, or you can just use their normal whole grain wraps you can buy as well. Absolutely fine. We've got some lamb's lettuce here, just fresh lamb's lettuce. We've got some pinto beans that came from a can, drained, and then rinsed, and that's it. So they're already cooked. We've got some baby tomatoes, some corn that you can get from supermarkets. This is actually grown in the UK as well, so down in Lincolnshire, I think it is. So we're just going to use that for a little bit of salad. We've got some avocado, some red onion, and some of this cooking sauce. It's tomatillo that you get from Mexico. You can buy any sort of, you know, cooking sauce from supermarkets. I'm going to get you to try this before I put it in the food because it does have jalapenos in.
Okay.
So, yeah, just a tiny bit on the teaspoon. Yeah, yeah, cool. Let's just see. All right, just try a little bit of that. And if it is too hot, we could do something else. It's a very mild sauce.
That's totally fine.
Is it all right?
I was just like preparing myself. It's actually fine. That's okay. I can totally handle that.
Okay, cool.
I feel quite proud of myself.
Okay, great. All right. So I'm going to do.
What's that? Are they just flowers?
These are just to make my worktop look pretty.
Oh, right, we can eat
those. But these are edible, actually.
You can
steep these in tea and stuff. We had a guest in earlier. She's a medical herbalist and she's a big fan of, like, you know, geranium and nettles and all that kind of stuff. So she actually taught me how to make a rose petal tea, which is very nice. Yeah. But also they make my worktop look very pretty. Okay, so we're just going to toast the sweet corn. I'm going to chop this off the cob, put that in the pan, take it off, and then I'm going to go in with the pinto beans, some of the baby tomatoes, the cooking sauce, essentially heat that up, and we're going to make a very quick guacamole with some smashed avocado, olive oil seasoning, and some red onion that I'm just going to chop.
I'm very excited about this because I do often eat guacamole, but I just buy it in a little thing. And so I wouldn't even know where to start.
I mean,
with
honestly, you're going to have your mind blown at how easy it is to make your own, and it tastes a lot better than the ones. It's kind of like hummus. If you make it from fresh, great. And then we're just going to build our tacos, and that's it.
Okay,
we're going to make enough for our studio audience here as well.
Okay.
Producers, your publishing team. Yeah. Okay, great. So, Max, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. The reason why I say that is because your book was one of the first things I read when I became a junior doctor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was, honestly. The title of which evades me now, but Confessions
trust
of a...
Me, trust me, I'm a junior doctor. Yeah.
Oh, it was great. Amazing, honestly. It was really good. So you got into the publishing world years ago.
Yeah. That book came out of a series of columns that I wrote for The Telegraph when I was like 23, just sort of, junior doctor.
Yeah.
And then after a year, I just got approached by Hodder, publishers, and they said, hey, why don't you turn this into a book? Uh-huh. And actually the column was really popular. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of kept writing it for actually a couple of years, even while the book was sort of out. And
yeah.
And then I did like a whole series just based on all the other columns I've been writing.
Yeah.
And then the column kind of changed because there's only so many stories you can tell.
Yeah.
Of like kind of little old lady.
Like a 2-year sort of, stint, right?
So now in my columns now, it's all kind of comment on news and stuff. Yeah. So now it's a bit more sort of serious.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was really interesting to sort of be able to detail, put down your experiences.
Yeah.
Every week about everything that was sort of happening.
Mm.
So I had a really good time. I really loved writing it. It was good.
It was amazing because I remember reading it before I started my house jobs at Basildon back in like 2009, over 10 years ago. And I remember reading it, I was like, oh my God, this is literally like what my life is right now. And it was so nice to actually someone who's written a book to kind of normalize my experience as well. And I think a lot of I shouldn't call them kids. A lot of the junior doctors coming out now are sort of resonating a lot with stuff that, we were going through 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Because it has changed, I suppose, there's some bits, occasionally now where we'll do like a book reading or something.
Yeah.
And I read back and think, oh no, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
Like, for example, there's a whole section about kind of losing x-rays.
Yeah.
Physical x-rays, of course, now everything's on computer.
Yeah.
And I kind of sit there and kind of cringe fighting and think, oh God.
Yeah.
Talking about tapes or, videos or something, and people are like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Things like that obviously have moved forward and sort of changed. And even just the rotas have sort of changed quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the way that sort of junior doctors now work. Mm. Because certainly when I was a junior doctor, we used to kind of work in firms, kind of little teams, and you'd be with your consultant for kind of 6 months.
Yeah.
Whereas now I think a lot of it is, which I don't think is necessarily an improvement at all, but now they kind of move around a lot more and they're kind of not attached to a particular team, and it's kind of, they're sort of like workers who are kind of like, attached to different bits on different days.
Yeah.
So some bits have changed, but I think probably the essential interactions with all the patients and all the kind of feelings and all that kind of stuff, I think probably is very similar.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, like the way you write is quite emotive as well, and it's very passionate. And I remember, I mean, they still work in firms as well, but they probably rotate a little bit more often. So it's like every 4 months rather than every 6 months. But instead of losing sort of x-rays, it's like a new sort of issue that we have to, like, losing the patient number or the patient number not being linked to the right PACS account. Yeah. And then, you can't access the x-rays. The bureaucracy is still there very much. So it's something I have to deal with all the time in A&E.
In a way, it's kind of reassuring almost in a way to think that, no matter what technological advances there are, it's still going to be a bit rubbish.
We can still mess it up somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so after you wrote that, you wrote two books of
three books in that sort of series about sort of my life as a junior doctor. So the second one was after being a junior doctor, I then went into work into mental health. I did sort of lots of different jobs. Again, you can't sort of do that so much now, but kind of a while back, you used to be able to sort of just do standalone jobs where you just go and get some experience for 6 months in a particular area and then sort of leave it and move on. Mm. So I worked with a homeless outreach project that in the time it was covering King's Cross before kind of King's Cross became cool.
Cool,
before Google moved in and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was based in there and we kind of covered Covent Garden, Soho and sort of all very central London.
Yeah.
And then I also then worked for a drug and alcohol project.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote a book about that experience.
Amazing.
Sort of just talking about homelessness and what it's like working with homeless people and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my third book was about sort of dementia, because I then went off and worked in dementia.
Yeah. Whereabouts did you work in dementia?
So I worked up in a hospital called St Pancras Hospital.
Okay.
It's a really old Victorian, I think, workhouse.
Yeah.
And it's always very scary.
Like St Mary's.
Yeah. Very similar architecture. Yeah. So it's all kind of red brick.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing, kind of, working there. I really loved it. It's really beautiful. But lots of particularly the GP people who rotated in were petrified.
Really?
Loads of people when they were on call. We had this like really scary on call room, and it was always creaking and stuff like this. And they'd all like sit in their cars and refused to go to the old call room, spend the whole night in their car. But So I worked there, and it's all, again, it's all covered just central London. So it was like dementia services for central London. And again, this was quite a while ago. So it was all kind of these, you know, elderly ladies who lived in these mansion blocks in, you know, Bloomsbury. And they sort of lived there for like 40 years or 50 years. And, you know, then become very elderly. And now, of course, they've all been sold off in their solicitors' firms and this kind of stuff. But this, it was just at the sort of like ending of this kind of era of kind of older people who'd sort of, you know, moved in there maybe in their sort of 20s and 30s and sort of just grown old there. So now it's all sort of changed. I think the whole of that service has very much changed now because of the changing demographic.
And how did you know that you wanted to go into psychiatry? Because that was, that's what you're ultimately
right? So I actually, you know, I always wanted to go into psychiatry. I went into medical school to work in mental health.
That's very rare.
I know, it is very rare. And actually, I remember that my medical school interview, I said this, and the professor who's kind of interviewing me kind of took off his glasses, went, "Why ever would you want to do that?" So when I was sort of 15 or 16, I was actually quite naughty at school, and I used to kind of play truant quite a lot.
Really?
It's about a long story short, right? I was really quite naughty. And I sort of like ended up being, this sort of woman took me under her wing, really, and she was a manager of a small day hospital in a place called Chalvey, which is like sort of west of London near Slough, and it's kind of quite an impoverished area. And she sort of took me under her wing and sort of did work experience with me and sort of said, you know, you should be a doctor. And she really encouraged me. Yes. It never occurred to me to be a doctor until she came along. I was like 15, 16, something like that.
Okay.
And actually, the plan had been, my sort of family's plan for me had been that I was going to leave at 16 and go and work in a Marfar factory, which is in Slough.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, one of my mum's friends' kids had done. So she was convinced, like, that's going to be the answer, go and work in the Mars factory.
Yeah.
And then this lady, Anne...
Because you wanted all the sweets and
that. Exactly. It's nothing to do with my future career. It's just because she liked Maltesers. And then this lady, Anne, sort of was like saying, no, you should go off and be a doctor. And actually, this day hospital... it sort of, it was like a remnant of kind of, you know, the olden days that's sort of been forgotten about almost.
Yeah.
And it was everybody who worked there seemed really passionate. They all worked there because they felt, you know, really strongly about sort of advocating for the patients, and lots of them had mental health problems.
Right.
And like I remember
people,
as in lots of the patients had mental health problems.
Fine,
so it was a day program for older people, but you know, often they'd had strokes or they had dementia or they had kind of, you know, chronic mental health problems. And so I just got this idea that actually being a doctor is about sort of standing up for people and advocating for people.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of find, you know, the people in society that have maybe not got a voice.
Yeah.
And so it just was always in my head of like, well, I want to go and work with people with mental health problems because they haven't got anyone standing up for them and sort of fighting for them.
Mm.
So it was just in my head. I was like, well, that's what I'm going to do. I didn't even know how to become a doctor. So we had this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's like, because no one, my dad was a milkman. So there was like, no, you know,
there wasn't
like a kind of idea of like, oh, this is what you have to do. I didn't even know you had to go to university.
And
sort of like said, oh no, no, this is what you have to do, and sort of really, really helped me. And so then I went to medical school, but it was with the intention of going back to somewhere like this hospital.
Gotcha, yeah.
To kind of help that kind of patient group.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's amazing that you were dissuaded in the middle of your medical school interview to go into psychiatry and start. Did you almost feel like it was like your responsibility to prove that professor?
Exactly. Do you know, that's exactly what it was like. It kind of made me even more kind of think, right,
yeah,
you know, I'm definitely going to do it now.
I'm definitely going to do this now, yeah. Oh, that's great. And so now you work in North London.
Yeah, that's right. So
you have, but you have like a very varied career at this point, right? Because obviously you do columns, you write children's books now, you know, you're doing stuff on radio quite often.
I feel quite privileged. I'm sure you like you, you know, it's like, I love doing medicine,
but
just on its own it can become, I think, quite overwhelming.
Absolutely.
And it's really nice to have like lots of other different things to kind of keep you occupied. And particularly for me, kind of being able to write, you know, so I write a column every week. And so, you know, your kind of thoughts you have in your head or the kind of things and frustrations, to be able to have, you know, an outlet for that, you know, is fantastic. I don't think I would be able to, so I work full time in the NHS, and I don't think I'd be able to handle working full time, ironically, if I didn't also do other stuff.
Yeah, so you work full time.
Because quite a lot of my colleagues, and I think particularly in GP, people tend now to work part time, which is understandable, I think, just because the stresses.
Whereas yeah, actually, even I work two to three days a week now, right. Clinical, because I've just got so much other stuff to do, like smashing avocados, yeah. which is actually, for the listeners, I've just done. So in this pan, we've taken out the sweet corn that I've just dry toasted, just to bring out a little bit of the water and give a little bit of colour to the sweet corn.
Did you put oil in the pan first?
No. So that was no oil in that one. That was just raw sweet corn, just chopped off of the cob. In here we've got the pinto beans, the baby tomatoes that I've just halved, the cooking sauce, a little bit of seasoning, and some paprika as well, a bit of pepper, that's about it. And this is literally just to warm it up. Mm-hmm. And now I'm making a guacamole that is going to blow your mind, how simple it is. I'm just taking
that was a miracle how you just did that. Extraordinary. I want a replay of that. That was amazing.
We might have to get this in slow motion. I don't know. So this is the, I don't know if I can redo it now because it's kind of webbed in it. But
okay.
You just basically firmly but confidently
put
the sharp knife into the seed and then you twist it very gently and then it pops out like that.
That is amazing. Because actually, that is one of the things that puts me off avocados.
I can imagine,
Is that I'm like, how do you get the thing out? And then you squidge it and it's all gone.
Yeah. We see a lot of avocado-related injuries, One of my... So I used to work at...
such a middle-class injury.
Well, I mean, avocados are becoming the norm now, aren't they? Everyone's putting them in their smoothies and stuff, so... Yeah, so like I used to work for a plastic surgeon. He was a hand surgeon in particular, and he was like, avocados are one of the most dangerous vegetables that you've got because I suppose it's a fruit, it's the seed, but it's because people just don't know and they go like this and they go straight through and then into the hand, obviously. So you're gonna be really, really careful when you do that. I should look after my tacos.
This is like high risk cooking.
It's high risk cooking, I know, right? Who would have thought? So yeah, I'm just gonna smash this with the back of a fork. I've put both the segments in a bowl, a little bit of seasoning and some olive oil. And then I'm just going to chop some onion as well.
That's quite a lot of salt.
So,
do you worry about salt? Because I was going to ask you this.
Because
I try to never use salt. I mean, I don't actually also cook. But I never add salt to anything because I'm also paranoid about my high blood pressure. But then I was reading that actually maybe there's not such a close link as we think there is.
So what do you think? Definitely a link with convenience products and sort of takeaway food and the way they use salt in that respect. Yeah. I think if you use the right amount of salt at the right time, you don't need to oversalt.
Okay.
We probably have unequivocal evidence that excess salt is certainly related to cardiovascular issues. But using that probably looked like a lot, but it was probably like a quarter teaspoon. Okay. And because I'm using sea salt, the crystals themselves, when you bite into them, they actually exhibit quite a lot of that salt flavor.
Right.
So you don't need to use that much. And also, this is going to be used as a garnish.
So is it better than to use the crystals than the normal like table salt?
I actually prefer it that way. Yeah. It sounds like a bit of a sort of, you know, middle class thing to do as well. Like, oh, we're going to go for the Maldon sea salt. But I honestly think flavor wise, it's fantastic. So, yeah, that's why. What are we talking about now?
Sorry, that's my fault.
No, that's great. I mean...
Hand injuries related to this. Middle class injuries.
This guacamole, honestly, it's super simple. I'm just going to... Do you know how to dice an onion? I should have taught you that, actually. Okay, so...
I mean, let's be honest. What do you think the answer is? I've just managed to work out that is an onion.
So we've got a red onion. Okay. So just sliced it lengthways so it goes through the stem at the bottom.
Right.
The trick to this is you want to keep the bit at the bottom because it holds all these beautiful segments together.
Okay.
And you just peel the outside of it. Actually, I've done a few YouTube videos on this as well, just how to chop an onion properly. Put that to one side. And so this is where the base is here. So you just want to firmly and with a nice sort of claw technique, just chop lengthways like that. I'm doing it quite thick just to show you here. You can do it thinner once you know. And then the same way, and then you've got a nice fine dice. You see that?
It's quite impressive. I don't actually know what I would do. I literally don't know. If someone said dice an onion, I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure.
This is why we need culinary classes in medical school. That's actually something that I'm working on with culinary medicine.
Because actually, a long time ago, I worked in South London in a drugs project.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the main issues we had was kind of basically malnutrition amongst people because they're not prioritizing eating. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we realized was that we would sort of say like, oh, make sure you eat properly.
Yeah.
And actually in the area, it was in a kind of place at Charlton in Woolwich.
Yeah, I know Woolwich.
Literally, there was no shops that sold any kind of fresh vegetables or fruit. I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
And so you were sort of saying to people, we'll go off and eat fresh fruit and vegetables. And
Absolutely.
I wasn't able to buy it.
Yeah.
And then even when then you'd sort of say, right, okay, you know, go to Sainsbury's over here. And we used to kind of get vouchers for them and stuff. They wouldn't know literally how to cook the food.
Exactly.
Because they'd never, and so you get sort of people in their 20s and 30s quite literally not even knowing like how, what red pepper is and things like that.
So it's, and it's really heartbreaking. I was at a food conference last year, and then we had these primary school kids that came in, and some of them was the first time they'd seen a baby tomato. And I'm like, what is this? I'm like, it's a baby tomato, like everyone should know, but these sort of simple accessible ingredients. And so to go back to your point about how people don't know how to cook with the items or where to buy them as well, it's one of the things that we teach in culinary medicine to the medical students. So food education is something that just isn't in school, so no one else, you should expect a very low level of food literacy. And the second thing is you need to keep it as simple as possible and accessible. So 1 pound meals that we're doing here, foods that you can buy in food banks, and also be considerate of the fact that some of these cans require a tin opener and people don't have tin openers. You know, they don't have like the basic equipment. So it's a real issue, and that 4 million people in the UK are using food banks. I don't think a lot of people realize that, and that, you know, given that we live in one of the richest democracies in the world, it's just crazy.
And I suppose some of the difficulty with the food bank thing is that actually it's quite sometimes quite unusual food or random food and
Absolutely.
stuff, and so actually the level of skill you need to be able to think, oh, well, I've got this, and this, and I can combine those into this meal. Actually, I mean, I definitely wouldn't be able to do that,
unless
I've got, like, the four things I always go for. You know, if people gave me a random selection of food, I'd have no idea.
Totally, yeah, absolutely. And so, it's one of those things I think we need to be a lot more confident at giving nutrition advice. Very simple, pragmatic advice, because not everyone, unfortunately, has access to a nutrition professional, nutritionists that work in the NHS, dietitians. You can only refer as a general practitioner under strict sort of circumstances. So, let's go back to the food.
Yeah.
You're going to eat this. So we've got a guacamole that is just made there very quickly. Some of the sweet corn and the lamb's lettuce. I'm just going to put this to one side. And I've just warmed the tacos on a dry pan behind me. And then we're just going to build it. So how would you like it? It's up to you. We can either go guacamole first.
Yeah.
It's kind of like scones.
What do you think? How would you do it?
I would go. And don't worry, I'm not going to make you eat it with your hands if you don't want on camera, because we're probably going to
eat it.
I mean, you can use a knife and fork, but if you want to go,
isn't it?
It's a hand
it,
one. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. All right. For that, with that in mind, I'm going to go in with the lamb's lettuce as the base, and the sweet corn. There you go. Really do hope you like this. I mean,
it's only you. This is actually literally my lunch. I haven't had lunch. So.
Okay, good. It's our lunch as well.
So you've done like two together. How did you get them to stick together?
Oh, I didn't stick them together. They're separate. So I've just popped them on like that. So we're going with a little bit of the beans here. And you can make this with like, traditionally you've got like barbacoa, you've got like al asador, which is kind of like a kebab. But we make it slightly healthier. So we've got some beans, some tomatoes, the phytonutrients from that. And then we're just going to top it off with a little bit of that guacamole on the top here. And there we go. I was just about to ask you a question whilst you were eating there. Sorry. Do you eat that much?
It's actually lovely.
You good?
It's not spicy at all.
Good.
It's literally perfect.
I'm glad.
That's really nice.
Good.
That's really lovely.
Good. I'm really glad
you're pleasantly surprised. And I don't mean that in a whole way.
I'm pleasantly surprised as well.
But as in, like, because just that doesn't look like it's going to be that amazingly tasty, but actually it's incredible.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Good. I mean, it's just like, you know, the right mix of ingredients. I was going to ask you, do we eat out much? Like, you know, you go to restaurants. What's your favourite sort of cuisine? I should have asked you that before I even got you in the kitchen.
So I actually quite like, if as long as it's not too spicy, I quite like Oaxaca.
I
can handle Oaxaca.
Okay.
I always have the same things every time, but I like that.
That's fine.
And I really, I kind of like anything chicken-y. I was vegetarian for a really long time.
All right.
And then probably about 8 years ago or so, something just clicked in my head and I thought, I really craved kind of chicken, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I thought, and I just decided, you know, I'm not going to be vegetarian anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I tried red meat, because I hadn't really ever eaten red meat particularly. Mm-hmm. And then I just didn't like it. So I thought, I didn't really see the point of making myself eat something if I don't particularly like it.
Sure.
So I just really like chicken. I like fish. Mm-hmm. I try not to eat too much fish for kind of environmental reasons. Mm-hmm. So I just pretty much just eat chicken and then vegetables.
Great.
So yeah, so if it's...
And you eat 10 vegetables a day.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot better than the general public there, mate.
Well, I think the key thing is not bothering to cook it. If I had to cook it, I wouldn't bother. But it's because you just cut it up and then it's just there and you kind of sit there, reading or whatever, just chomping away. So yeah.
Oh, well, that's great. So, Max... I'm glad you enjoyed your tacos.
They were very good. I'm very impressed. And I promise you, I'm going to make them. And I'm going to take a photo of it and I will send it to you, I promise.
Please do.
But I'm slightly worried about where I'm going to find the blue ones from.
Oh, you don't need to go, but you don't need to.
But I will try, because I want it to be exactly the same, so you're proud of me.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm proud of you if you just get the beans right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the marvelous adventure of being human.
Yeah.
This is fantastic. I love the fact that, you know, you're trying to educate kids in how their body works and stuff. Actually, that was one of my first introductions into why I wanted to be a doctor. Do you remember that series called How My Body Works?
No. What channel was this on?
It was like a series of books, quite similar length to this. But every week it was like, I must have spent so much money on my parents did anyway.
Hang on. Was this like a thing you like subscribed to?
Yes.
You go into the thing and you get it and then you realise, you think it's only a pound. Yeah. And then about 3 years later, you realise you could have actually bought a human body. In fact, I think my sister did this one. I did one called Countryfile and my sister did that one. Yeah. And they actually just ended up. Sadly, just ended up stacking up in their little plastic bottle.
Exactly. Like, you actually build a body, like, you know, this one week you get the liver and it will tell you what the liver does and stuff like that. But that was a scam. This, on the other hand,
this is not a scam.
This is much cheaper. This is much cheaper and marvellously illustrated as well. So tell me, what possessed you to write a children's book?
Well, do you know, I thought it'd be really easy. It actually turned out to be quite difficult. Yeah. It's probably one of the hardest books, certainly, that I've written. I had this idea of kind of trying to make, you know, the human body and biology and stuff kind of a bit more interesting for children. And I was kind of inspired by this study that had been done in the British Medical Journal quite a few years ago that basically kind of just went out and it just asked random members of the general public and said stuff like, what side is your liver on? Mm. You know, what does your kidney do? And
adults,
stuff like that.
Right?
Yeah, adults. Yeah, adults. And they didn't know. Mm. And it kind of, you know, and it was published as this sort of quite startling sort of piece of research saying that actually, you know, doctors sit there and we talk about organs and so on, you know, really quite basic things that we assume is quite basic, and actually the people we're talking to really don't understand. And so I sat thinking, oh, you know, so I want to kind of it's really important that not only doctors maybe understand how to pitch what they're saying, but also trying to educate the general public. And then it occurred to me, you should start with children.
It's the same thing with food, right? Like, you want to start with teaching children how to cook, to recognize ingredients, to recognize vegetables and that kind of stuff. In the same way, we need to teach them how to be medically literate with anatomy. Because, I mean, I see this all the time as an A&E doctor. Someone will come in and they'll say, I've got heart pain. What they mean is, I have pain in my chest or this part of my body here. But they immediately assume this is definitely cardiac.
Yeah.
And you know, the same thing with kidney. I have kidney pain. But it's actually, you know, on the side of their abdomen. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean it's kidney. Yeah. A whole bunch of
them. And you sort of say to people, like, where's your stomach? And they always think, oh, it's here.
Yeah.
And actually, they don't realize your stomach's up so much higher.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, these really basic things where when you've done, you know, years and years and years at medical school and you've done human dissection and you've done all this kind of stuff, it's just in your head, and you can't believe anybody doesn't know this. And, you know, I often have people, when I used to work in alcohol services, and they talk about their kidneys. Mm. And I know I'm damaging my kidneys.
Yeah.
And you think, no, you mean your liver.
Yeah.
And they don't even they know that it's somehow bad for them, but they don't even understand what it is that's bad. And, you know, I have to spend quite a lot of time educating your patients. And so, and I had this idea about it maybe making it a bit of fun, and rather than it just being sort of dry, like boring anatomy, of this idea of, like, we could kind of go on a journey and kind of shrink down into these kind of, you know, tiny people and go around the body.
Yeah.
And I remember watching this film. I think I must have been very, very young. I'm, you know, like probably 4 or 5. And it was that was one of the themes of the thing, is all these scientists shrunk down and had to go into somebody's body.
I think I've seen that.
Yeah,
I can't remember. It was like a spaceship. They went into like a spaceship and they went around the body and they had like red blood cells flying.
Yeah, that's right. They kind of had this in my mind. And I thought, because I remember that, and I thought, God, you know, I remember that sort of, you know, from 30 years ago, and it sort of stuck in my head.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that's a kind of adventure. I need to make it kind of exciting for kids, so it's not like boring.
Yeah.
And then, so I thought that was the kind of premise that I was working on. And then I thought, and I want to kind of bring in this idea of particularly things like food and nutrition, and like why it's important to look after your body.
Yeah.
And you know, because again, I think doctors sort of sit and say, oh, you shouldn't smoke, you shouldn't drink, you should eat properly. But actually, it's, if you don't understand why, you don't, can't put it in a context, it's just meaningless.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of then litter throughout the books these kind of little nuggets of kind of, you know, this is why it's important to eat properly. This is why it's important to eat, you know, vegetables, because actually you need them. And yeah, it's nutrition and so on and so on, and kind of just introduce the children to those kind of bigger ideas.
And I suppose inadvertently, what you're also doing is educating the parents that are going to be reading this book to them, right? And that's the thing. That's probably like how we sort of subtly educate everyone, by posing it as a children's book. But I can imagine tons of people looking at it. It's like, oh my God, that's like how capillaries work. And I didn't actually realize
that's before. My sister said exactly the same thing. So the first book I got, I gave to my nephew, he's sort of 7. And my sister then texted me, I can't believe, I didn't know half the stuff in this book.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite funny.
Yeah, and we normalise the anatomy because it's something that we deal with all the time. And, you know, through medical school, 6 years of that or less, you know, it just becomes normal. Okay, everyone knows where your liver is, for example. Everyone knows your general anatomy. But actually, I'm sure as you've gone through reading, making this book, you realise that how illiterate we are. In terms of,
and also I realised that I didn't know lots of stuff.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, I sat thinking,
I love the honesty, mate.
How does the eye work? Because you realise
this is the thing. Is not very well taught.
It's not very well.
Yeah.
That took a long time in the library going, oh, wow. Because you realise that it's one of those things, and I remember this in journalism, is that actually it's relatively easy to write for kind of like a, you know, highbrow audience, you know, where everybody knows everything. You know, you can kind of summarise a government white paper quite easily.
Yeah.
Actually, what's really hard is writing for, say, the Sun, where you're pitching it is much lower, because you have to really understand it yourself. And that's kind of how I felt about writing this book, was that in order to explain it to a child, you have to know it absolutely, absolutely, completely, and like the back of your hand.
Yeah.
And actually, some of the things I thought, oh, do you know, I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
How does that quite work?
Yeah.
And so I have to then sort of go away and spend a day or two kind of rereading stuff and thinking, oh, yeah, of course.
I find it humbling, actually, when, because my hospital, there's a large focus on teaching medical students, teaching people during their training as well, so everyone have 2 doctors. It's really humbling when they ask you a very simple question about how something works, and then you think you know it in your head, but actually when you try and verbalise it, it heightens to you, oh, actually, I don't understand how that works. And it forces you to go back to the reading, and then you can see one do and teach one. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, right?
And it really does work really well. And I love how illustrated this is. I mean, you know, you don't shy away from things like cytoplasm, cell membrane. And you told me about how you were trying to figure out how to explain blood pressure.
Oh, see, this is the thing. Again, it was so interesting because, you know, I just assumed you could, you know, not to use too long words, but actually basically you could talk about concepts just as you would with an adult.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, so ignorant of me, because what was it? So one of the pages, for example, is on blood vessels.
Yeah.
And the difference between veins and arteries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the main differences, like functional differences, is that the blood is under a lot of pressure in an artery, and it's not under so much pressure in a vein, but actually you need to go against gravity. So, you know, this is the issue, and you've got the gravity kind of pulling it down, particularly things like your legs. So they're the kind of main differences, and that kind of, you know, they translate into structurally how they're different. So I then tried to explain this, and then wrote this very, I thought, very nice kind of straightforward explanation, sent it off, and straight away my editor sent it back and went, no, because children at that age don't have a concept of pressure.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
Yeah.
How do you explain pressure without using the concept of pressure?
Pressure,
this is a nightmare.
Yeah.
It's actually very, really, really difficult. And we were, you know, and there was a section on the kind of skeleton and bones. Mm. And what I wanted the children to kind of understand was that bones aren't kind of something boring and static, that they're dynamic and they're constantly changing and they're remodeling all the time. And actually, they're not just there just to give us support, but also they serve a really important detoxifying sort of feature. And that's, you know, if you have certain chemicals in your body that your body cannot get rid of, then it buries them deep in the bone and kind of like hides them. And, you know, so actually they're incredibly functional and they serve this amazing, you know, purpose in our body. And so then I wrote about this and they were like, no, because the concept of chemicals is too hard for them at this age. And I was like, well, how can I talk about chemicals without using the word chemical?
It's really hard. Yeah, and you must have seen so many things like that, like just hitting a wall, like, okay, I'm going to go really, really basic. But you know what? Those things that you just mentioned there, I don't think a lot of the adult population would realise. Like, they probably think of bone as something that's solid, something like stone, without realising it's full of vasculature. It is pivotal to a whole bunch of other processes in our body, calcium metabolism and, you know, homeostasis and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm just looking at that page now, the designer jeans, for example. Explaining jeans to kids, come on.
I know. And also, I did it, like, as it's in the book, I wrote it like that. So the first kind of couple, I was thinking, you know, what is a cell? And I was thinking, I don't think I even know what a cell is anymore. Yeah, you know, I thought I knew all this stuff and I really don't. But it was actually, it was really sort of interesting trying to sort of strip it back. And actually, I think it was quite useful for me as a doctor, realising, actually, what words do I use? And I remember a long time ago, I was with a patient and she was describing how she was, you know, very distressed and she had this kind of terminal condition and, you know, she'd had a heart attack and she was going to die at any point and stuff. And I was looking through the history and I thought, this doesn't quite make sense. Mm. And I was saying to her, like, you know, but you have had a heart attack, but what makes you think that that's you're going to die now? I don't understand. You know, the cardiologist says you're fine, you've been discharged from hospital. And she said no, because they kept on saying it was acute. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, they were saying it's acute. Now, in her mind, this is a woman kind of in her 60s, in her mind, acute meant terminal.
Right.
So it was just a misunderstanding of the word. And I sat thinking, God, all these people, all these doctors have been coming using this word repeatedly. And actually, it's no fault of your own. Actually, they've just been failing to explain properly what that word actually means. Yeah. So actually, when I was writing this book, it really sort of helped me think, actually, what words am I using that maybe I'm taking for granted that I know what they mean, but actually they need a proper explanation.
Yeah, and you know what? I think a lot of professionals, medics who listen to this podcast as well, will probably think about that when they go back into the practice, whatever that might be. Even me, I'm thinking about it now because I work mainly in A&E these days and I have to get across quite complicated subjects very quickly in a short amount of time, but the way and the vernacular that I'm used to using perhaps is sometimes pitched too high, too low in some cases, but probably too high most of the time. And that's reframing how I think I should be explaining things. You know, as part of my general practice training, we did our CSA and, you know, clinical OSCEs and that kind of stuff. And a couple of the stations are communication based, and how do you explain to someone what COPD is, first of all, how that differs and how that's an umbrella term for a whole bunch of other things, and how to treat it all in that short space of window whilst understanding what level of education level and literacy level the patient has in front of you.
I do a lot of work with psychologists. I work very closely with psychologists. And I remember sort of having this actual exact discussion with a psychologist who gave me such a brilliant tip, which was like, at the end, say to the patient, can you explain to me what I've said to you?
Yeah.
And you know, now I do that every single time, every single consultation I do that. And it's really quite sobering.
Yeah.
Some patients have got, exactly, some patients will just listen and hear one particular bit that you kind of was a throwaway thing that you didn't think was that important, or you just kind of mentioned it, and then that's the bit they've kind of stuck with.
Yeah.
And other bits, you realise that actually some patients have really quite misunderstood what you've been saying, and you've been having one conversation and they've been hearing a totally different conversation.
Absolutely.
And that is, kind of right towards the end, it then gives you this perfect opportunity to kind of correct any misinformation.
So
writing this book, it sort of really gave me this, really made me think even more about this again and again, about, you know, the kind of the words, the vocabulary that we use, the assumptions we make about what people understand, what they don't understand.
That's a really good point. And, you know, I try and use that tip quite a bit throughout my sort of medical work. But also when I wrote my two books, I actually had people who weren't clinically trained, who weren't medics or whatever, read the chapters and summarize it back to me, because there's so much nuance. And when you're trying to explain eating for skin disorders or eating to prevent cancer and all these different things, and you'd never want to be misinterpreted, particularly on a public health level, you know, oh, this means this cures X, Y, Z. And that's why, you know, I put a lot of effort into sending out the chapters before they got published, getting some feedback and getting them to explain, okay, what did you learn from this chapter? Was it this that you took away, or was it this? And, you know, getting that feedback to make sure that your message is being communicated properly.
Yeah, I think it tends to be GPs or people who've gone through GP training tend to be much better at that.
Yeah.
From my experience, it is often, not always, a massive generalisation.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is sometimes hospital doctors. And I think it's because they live in such a, such a closed world.
Yeah.
And, you know, they interact with nurses who are experts and they know their kind of thing, their area, and they work with maybe dietitians who know their kind of thing. And so everybody's sort of talking using the same vocabulary, and it just you just assume that that world you know is out there as well, and I suppose GPs, because you do lots more loan working, actually the main interactions you have is with patients.
It's with patients,
so actually there's not such an assumption of knowledge.
We actually, and not to blame hospital doctors at all, because they're fantastic, and some of them are fantastic communicators.
Listen, we're both in a hospital.
I know, doctor, I know.
I don't think I'm late.
But so sometimes when I work in primary care, I have to undo a lot of misinformation that the patient has taken away from that consultation. So, you know, after seeing an endocrinologist and they don't understand why their thyroid medication has changed, for example, I have to go really back to basics. Okay, this is what your thyroid does. This is why they've changed your medication. These are the other things that you can do with your lifestyle to support all this other stuff and how it interacts with the other medications. Because, you know, they have very short consultation times as well, very much similar to what we have, like 8 to 9 minutes. So, you know, for them, like you were saying, it's just completely normalized. You just brush through thyroid, like, or endocrinology issues, and just, see as many patients as possible without really thinking about their understanding.
And often, I suppose, the kind of the sickest people end up kind of then going to see like the professor or something.
Yes.
Who, and they were often quite, it's quite touching, because they're often really sort of like, oh, I'm seeing the consultant, I'm seeing the professors or whatever.
Yeah.
And actually those people are often living in an even more rarefied environment.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they're kind of, their area of expertise is incredibly honed down. So it becomes very difficult for them to understand.
Mm.
And I think that's really, that's one of my sort of passionate things, is, you know, kind of generalists within medicine, and why they're so important is because they can stand back and give a much more holistic kind of view, and it really help the patient, sort of advocate for them, sort of, you know, help them through that patient journey in a way that maybe the kind of really uber specialists would sort of struggle to.
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of the way I'm trying to get more people in specialism to think. That's why culinary medicine, like, kind of skips through loads of different conditions, and why food isn't just in the realm of specialist nutritionists and dietitians or even general practitioners. Is actually everyone's responsibility, in the same way it's everyone's responsibility to bring up smoking cessation or screening, or, you know, all the other sorts of tools at a public health level. And I think that's a real, I mean, I have a bias here, but I really think food is the great leveler across different specialties, and why everyone should be chatting a bit more about it, and how it's obviously very important to the human body as well. So what was the most difficult chapter to write?
Well,
I just
probably, you know, it's that. It was
I literally
that.
Just
well, because I felt very, I did feel very strongly. So
just,
I would
just
say,
for the listeners.
So I was the page on male and female anatomy, because obviously at the age of, so it's pitched at around sort of the age of seven to sort of 10.
Uh-huh.
And actually at that age, it is a sensitive sort of topic to bring up. And this is not a sex education book.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is a book about the human body.
Yeah.
But in it, inevitably, we're talking about kind of form and function. Mm-hmm. And so we are inevitably talking about like what those parts of your body do.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to kind of walk that fine line between explaining, you know, what a penis does without going into the ins and outs, if you excuse
me.
It was very, very difficult to do that. And to do it also in a kind of, in a sensitive way that would appeal to kind of people from, you know, all different backgrounds with kind of, you know, different kind of sensibilities.
Yeah.
So I would say that took a lot of going to back and forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of kind of talking to different people, sort of thinking like, you know, how could I phrase this in a sort of an honest way. The other thing is, you know, I didn't want to kind of brush over things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad that you didn't shy away from this, because like, just for the listener, you know, we have pictures of the vagina, ovaries, uterus. It's really, really important, because a lot of adults don't understand the difference between these different bases. So I am an ambassador for the Eva Pill, and they're a charity that essentially raises awareness of the 5 gynecological cancers. And they've done some research about illiteracy of females and their anatomy, and they don't know how to describe things like labia, vagina, etc. And that actually is a lot of embarrassment. There's a massive taboo subject, taboo around going to the doctor and speaking about bleeding and pain and all these different things, for fear of embarrassment and not being taken seriously. So actually, like we were saying, you're planting the seed very early in children to learn about the anatomy, understand how it actually works and why that's important later on in life as well.
And I wanted it to be something about, this is not anything to be ashamed of. Mm. This is, you know, everybody's got their, you know, bits down there. It's kind of perfectly normal. Mm. And, you know, we shouldn't kind of shy away from having those conversations. And it's like, it was a very delicate, difficult line to walk. Yeah. And, you know, things like the illustration has got a sanitary towel and a tampon, because I was like, you know, these aren't things that people should be ashamed of in any way. It's normal. And I wanted to kind of celebrate the fact, you know, there's a section about women's breasts saying they all come in all different sizes and shapes, and that's normal and it's okay. Mm. Because, you know, I wanted to try and get that message across, you know, before people, you know, before the children have kind of entered into puberty, they've already had that sort of seed planted that, these are our bodies, they're normal, and that's okay. And it's okay to talk about them and stuff. And yeah, and certainly when I used to work, a long time ago, I used to work in child psychiatry, and you'd have some really heartbreaking conversations with children where you realise that the level of ignorance and the kind of shame attached to their bodies. Mm. And you know, they'd be like 14-year-olds and you think, where's this come from? It's awful. I've got a friend of mine that is a beautician. She runs her own clinic, and she frequently has to turn away teenagers, like young girls, you know, kind of 13, 14, because they've come because they want to be fully waxed.
Wow.
Because they're saying it's not natural and they don't want to do about it. And they're very distressed. And she has to kind of take them aside and kind of explain that actually, you know, pubic hair is normal and it's okay. And then they're kind of saying, well, no, boys want to sleep with me. Right. And it's kind of a part of a much more complex kind of sociocultural situation. Absolutely. So I kind of wanted in a very small way to kind of be like sort of celebrating people's bodies and there's nothing to be ashamed
of. Well, I think this is in a very big way, because I think that's a very sort of important topic to raise. I mean, I did a little bit of, I did psychiatry as part of my general practice training. What I did when I was in pediatrics, I was in Brighton Medical School. Mm-hmm. We did some work at the Royal Alexander. And I remember having some patients who were as young as 11, maybe even younger than that, coming in with eating disorder. They just wouldn't eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, the mother would be there, the father perhaps was traveling, and that's why they were sort of like rebelling in a certain way and they just stopped eating. I literally had no idea, this is going back like 7 or 8 years ago, I had literally no idea that we could have eating disorders in children.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as young as, you know, 10, 9. It's incredible. This is something that you deal with. This more.
Yeah. So this is my area that I work in. So I work in an eating disorder unit, and I deal with adults, or kind of teenagers transitioning into adult services, and then adults.
Which is a huge gray area itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But then there is a whole part of our service that deals with children, and it's very difficult. And part of it is kind of cultural and social, and the kind of influences that children pick up on around sort of, you know, idolizing certain body shapes and so on, and kind of preoccupations around certain types of food and so on. But also there's obviously a big psychological element. It's not simply just that. It's also a lot, particularly in younger people, often about kind of ideas around control, feeling you're very often out of control, because of course one of the first things we learn as babies to control is the food that we eat. So it's often younger people who feel out of control often regress back, and then they then start to control the food they eat as a way of kind of feeling more in control around things in their life.
And do you think that am I right in thinking that there's a rise of eating disorders in that particular age group as well, or is it a case of greater sort of awareness from a professional standpoint and greater detection?
So that's something that's a big, really, really good, very big question that people spent a lot of time trying to identify. I think it is actually probably a bit of both. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a number of older patients, maybe in the sort of 40s and 50s, even into their 60s, who have basically had an eating disorder their whole life, often since childhood. Uh-huh. And they will sit there and say, you know, I spent 10 years kind of in and out of just general hospital under pediatrics, because there just wasn't that understanding then. Like when you think, it wasn't until around sort of like 1978, I think it was, that bulimia was first, the phrase bulimia was first coined. Mm. So, I mean, it's actually very relatively recent that we've even kind of had words and vocabulary properly to kind of understand eating disorders. So, and you know, the first services are only about sort of 30 years old or so, sort of dedicated eating disorder services. So, so I think now that there's more and more awareness of it, obviously we then pick up more.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, years and years ago, these people were just in pediatrics, failure to thrive clinics, you know, kind of not really receiving any psychiatric help. But I do also think that because of things like the rise in social media, increased kind of pressures on children and so on and so on. Even down to things like, and it's maybe quite controversial, but things like atomization of the family. So kind of like family breakdown. We now don't have like, you know, our grandparents living next door as we maybe did do 50 years ago. You know, we don't have massive extended families with loads of aunties and uncles. So actually children, if your parents split up, that can be really catastrophic and you don't have anymore a kind of social network that maybe they did 50, 100 years ago. And so I think it's probably a combination of lots of very different things of kind of, you know, come together to create this spike that we have definitely seen. It's probably not as much as we think it is, because I think some of it's over detection. But certainly there is a bit of a spike in increase.
You work in quite a diverse area, I'm assuming, right? So you're around Tottenham internet area. So do you think there's a bit of a taboo around people from ethnic backgrounds and coming forward with depression? Because I know certainly in Indian culture, it's a very big taboo. And we live in that perfect sort of environment where we have the extended family, the parents, the grandparents, etc. But with that also comes a bit of pressure as well. And, you know, to go forward and actually go to your general practitioner or to go to anyone really and actually call for help is sort of looked down upon, maybe?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's still a lot of stigma within kind of Afro-Caribbean communities, within, you know, Indian communities. I do a lot of work, or lots of the patients we cover, the areas we cover have got a lot of Bangladeshi patients in, and there's a massive stigma amongst them with regard to mental illness. It's like a massive thing. It's very, very difficult. And often it will be kind of somatized. It will be kind of, it will be physical symptoms. So lots of my colleagues that work in GI medicine, so gastrointestinal medicine, will often see people kind of coming convinced they have some sort of, you know, bowel problem, and actually it's a manifestation of their distress, of their depression, of their anxiety. I mean, it's a very sort of common. I remember when I worked in A&E, you'd often get patients from ethnic minorities were coming describing kind of all over body pain
all
and
over.
And there would be often like this, often typically a kind of slightly older woman who would be there, and she'd just repeat it again, all over body pain, doctor, all over body pain. And there would be, the whole family would be around them. And I remember sort of, because I did anthropology when I was at medical school, and I remember sort of like thinking, it's really interesting from an anthropological perspective, how this one person maybe who feels kind of lost or forgotten within the family has now mobilized everybody around her. And suddenly it's become quite powerful because of using medicine and using this kind of, you know, this manifestation. Whereas maybe she was saying, I feel depressed, or I feel, you know, unloved, or I feel anxious, or whatever. It wouldn't mobilize people in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because certainly from an A&E point of view, we need to like determine whether this is has got a psychological element to it before excluding anything, like, you know, an organic cause. And we had a friend of mine come on who's a gastroenterologist, and she specializes in functional gut disorders.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, functional dyspepsia, functional diarrhea, IBS, one of the biggest ones that everyone knows about, and how breathing could be one of the interventions that could help with a whole bunch of other things. When you think about breathing, the fundamental thing that we do as humans, as well as eating, but that has a plethora of effects on our physiology, you know, on our gut symptoms, on our obviously oxygenation levels, our brain. Volitional breathing is part of like a meditative techniques, and how that could have an impact on our psychology as well.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating, but it's such a complicated topic, because they'll often, you know, come in, particularly as a general practitioner, convinced that this is a physical problem. And to even bring up the topic of it being perhaps related to stress, or, you know, poor sleep or anything like that, it's a really, really difficult topic.
Yeah, because I think it feeds into the kind of this idea of like the stigma that is attached to mental illness. It's like, it's not real, it's all in the mind. These kind of, you know, derogatory ideas around, you know, well, you know, I want a proper illness. I don't want something that's kind of, you know, me just being a bit crazy.
Yeah.
And it actually kind of feeds into that whole idea around mental illness isn't real illness.
Yes. Yeah.
And I feel very, really strongly about that, really passionate about it. And of course, by the time patients have come to me, often they've already had a level of acceptance of it, and they kind of understand it. But I think it's very hard for GPs, because they're often the ones that have to start that conversation. It's easier for me, because I can, you know, by the time they've got to see me, it's all being discussed.
Yeah.
But for GPs, they have to broach it often, and it's very, very hard to do.
Yeah, it's a tough topic. And plus, you know, you never want to be that practitioner, whether you're in primary care, secondary care, who misses something.
Of course.
Misses something big. You know, there are lots of random symptoms associated with cancer, and even your traditional sort of like cardiovascular issues, gut issues, that they can present in multiple ways. And often detaching yourself from that as a practitioner is quite hard because we're practicing quite litigation heavy medicine, I feel like. It's defensive medicine,
very defensive.
We're sort of going the way of the Americans, I feel, which is probably a bad way to go.
Well, I think it's sad because then it becomes not about the patient, and it becomes about you not wanting to get sued.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of to me is quite, that's not really how it should
it's
be.
It's quite upsetting though, but anyway, I don't want to end on that topic.
I think it's like nice little bunnies or something. We're talking about little rabbits.
Actually, one thing I did want to talk to you about is social media and actually how you feel that it's impacting, particularly on eating disorders. Orthorexia, along with many terms, is something that's recently been coined as the unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a whole bunch of other sort of terms around like a similar sort of concept like orthorexia that we have yet to define and we haven't come across yet? Or do you think we kind of know what the triggers are and then we need to just get on with treating and identifying this?
I mean, there is no doubt that social media does play a role. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no doubt. And you sit in a clinic and I will have, social media, Instagram gets brought up in my clinic probably, a dozen times a day. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is no doubt that it's playing a role. There is a bigger question of, but actually, if it wasn't for social media, is it causing this? Or is it just merely something that people are kind of, is kind of like hanging on to? Is it a hook? Would it be there anyway? Or would it just be, is Instagram causing?
Yeah.
These problems, or is it just that it's facilitating them? I suppose is a way of putting it. And I don't know, I think it's easy. I suppose we all like, doctors, everybody likes to think there's just one answer. We like, the bogeyman. So we can kind of go, oh, it's social media. Yeah. And I kind of think it's probably a bit more complicated than that, which is a really tedious answer. I'm really sorry.
No.
But I just kind of do.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think the people that now, say, well, my eating disorter started when I started looking at Instagram posts. There would have been something else, possibly, for a lot of those patients. Not all of them. I suppose what I don't like about social media is the way that it's removed from context. So we have had numerous patients within our service who have incredibly large social media followings. Mm. And they are posting about food, and they have an eating disorder. They are not eating what they are posting. And we know that they are then, binging on all sorts of things and making themselves sick, and that they are really tormented, really overwhelmed by their eating disorder, and yet you look on their social media and you would have no clue, and you would follow what they are recommending. Mm-hmm. And I sit there thinking there is, it's almost like a kind of public health intervention that needs to happen to say, actually, nobody should be listening to these people because they are actually mentally unwell with regard to food. So you should not be taking their advice on food, and they're not even doing what you think they're doing. They're not even following this. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult. And we've had lots of kind of ethical issues within our service of like, do we intervene? What do we do? How do we kind of protect the public from this? Because actually, it's that they're promoting something that's not even real.
Absolutely.
And I suppose that's what I don't like about it. I don't like the fact that lots of people think it's normal, for example, to have a thigh gap, mm-hmm. which is this kind of gap at the top of your thighs. Mm-hmm. So when you have your legs closed, you can still see space through them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is not normal. Mm-hmm. It is not, it happens in this very small minority of people who just anatomically are variants. Mm-hmm. They are, as I say to my patients, they're just genetic freaks. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in a nice way, but they just are. And you are not. And that's okay. Yeah, and, I want them to sort of celebrate their body. And yet they are constantly being bombarded with these images of kind of extraordinary people.
Yeah.
And it's like sitting there watching Wimbledon and then beat yourself up because you can't play tennis like that. And it's but those people are extraordinary.
Yeah.
They are, that is why they're on television doing Wimbledon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, if you're going to put that as where you're aiming for, you're inevitably going to be really disappointed. Mm. And that's how I feel about sort of social media, is it kind of gives this very false impression of what life is like. It sets up unrealistic expectations. Mm. And I think that is a sad thing. And, what I want to see on social media is people going like, sat here and eating three biscuits and stared out the window for an hour and their photo of that, because that is the reality of like life.
Absolutely.
And not, kind of everyone sort of skipping around in their latest kind of Gucci trainers it's not real.
Mm.
And that's what I kind of feel sad about. And that's what I don't like about social media. I do think there's positive things. I love the way that it kind of can connect people, and people often from kind of very diverse communities kind of can learn more about one another and so on and so on. And, kind of, people kind of in far-flung parts of the world can kind of get their news out and stuff. So I think there's loads of potential.
And there's a positive side to it, but as always, unfortunately with human nature, there's also big negative things that come out.
Absolutely, with any tool, I think there's definitely gonna be negatives that come out. And I think there's so many parallels between an unhealthy obsession with healthy eating and monetary attainment and wealth, and you know, people posting pictures of them traveling all the time, these amazing exotic locations. Sometimes that can compound a feeling of inadequacy in yourself.
Absolutely.
And as a doctor as well, and this is speaking from a personal point of view, you know, being on social media and talking about healthy eating and actually how I want people to live healthy, happier lives using food and lifestyle, it puts me in a bit of a disposition because I want to reflect the normal tendencies of what I do when I go to A&E, and that's why I'm always posting like the jelly babies that we have and like, you know, A&E wards and that kind of stuff. But I also want to educate people on why food is one of the most important health interventions. And in an era where everyone is scrutinizing exactly what you say, exactly how you say it, it's very hard to communicate a nuanced subject in 160 characters or a small comment post and stuff. And you've got to look at the totality of what people are putting out there. And it's very hard. It's a very aggressive place to be, I think, social media sometimes.
I mean, that's part of the reason why I kind of don't really engage with social media particularly, because I kind of feel, you know, obviously I'm very interested in other people's mental health. I'm also interested in my own mental health. And I sometimes find it's not a healthy place to be from a mental health perspective because you can feel very easily attacked or very inferior. Mm. Or, you know, I quite like not being on social media. Yeah. I'm on Twitter, which I very rarely sort of engage with particularly.
Twitter's pretty aggressive.
I like it. But I would say I'm kind of quite passive on Twitter. So I read stuff. So I read the news. But I've set my settings so that unless I follow somebody and they follow me, I can't see what they're saying about me. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, and that's, so mostly it's kind of friends, and that might not be friends in real life. It might just be friends that I've made over Twitter. But I like them enough that I want to hear what they're saying, and they clearly like me enough that they want to hear what I'm saying. So that's fine. I don't mind that. But everybody else I don't see. So if anybody's kind of getting angry to me or anything, I can't see it.
Because Max Pemberton, he didn't properly represent the female anatomy in his
book. But it's really interesting. And often people will take just one very small thing and they get very, very upset about it. Yeah. And I just think, oh, it's like that. Have you heard the new Taylor Swift song?
No, I haven't. I do like Tay Tay, but.
You need to calm down. And I kind of think it's down. About social media. And that's how I think about it. I'm just like, wow, everyone just needs to calm down. Yeah. It's okay. Like, geez, let's all be happy.
Tay Tay's she's pretty wise, isn't she?
I love her, honestly. I tell you. Honestly, I would marry her. Well, I really like the current one. This one is amazing.
Okay,
yeah,
I probably haven't heard it.
It's had 120 million listens or something. I just noticed it. I was listening to it on my way here.
Really? Okay. Was it all you?
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
My favourite song is 22. I know it's hard for me to admit that, but I really like 22.
Honestly, I think she's underrated.
Yeah.
I think she is. Same. I would quite happily marry her.
I think your partner would be very happy about that.
He'd be devastated, but.
It's very interesting to observe, I think, because even if you're trying to put out good content, people will misinterpret that and then that will spiral out of control.
Almost like willfully. This is what I think is interesting about it.
Yes.
It's almost like people want to be angry. And I think that, so I've tried to think about this from a psychiatry sort of point of view. And I think that actually a lot of people are very angry for a whole variety of complicated social reasons.
Yeah.
That actually sometimes the world is a really hard place. You know, even living in the UK in 2019, it's still really hard for a lot of people. And people, for a variety of reasons, feel very dispossessed, feel disengaged, feel kind of society isn't offering them something. And they have this kind of rage. Mm. And they are looking for somebody or something to direct it towards. Mm. And sometimes it happens to be you that sort of wanders in front of that. And so I try to never particularly take it personally when it does. And I just kind of sit there and think I'm just going to be really happy.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of things that I do sort of very mindfully to kind of keep myself really happy. And so
please,
one of them honestly, it's really banal.
No,
but one of them, and it really is, honestly, even just thinking about it makes me kind of all relaxed, is that every Thursday, so on a Wednesday, I have to start really, really late writing my column. And then on a Thursday, I have a very, very busy day and it's very kind of complicated at work. And I have a complex patient I have to see in the morning. So I have an assessment slot. So they've often been waiting for a very long time and it's kind of, you know, it requires a lot of my thought. And then I have to then go and I do, I work for like a little day program. So I have to go and do the ward round for that. And everything's quite stressful. So kind of Wednesday into Thursday has been quite stressful. Uh-huh. And so then on a Thursday evening, I leave work and I go to Sainsbury's Home Base. Okay. And I genuinely, I'm often followed by the security because I think they think, who is this guy? He's here every Thursday evening for about 3 hours. And I walk around saying it's his home base. And I almost always buy a houseplant because I really love houseplants. And yeah. I've got two things in my life is that I really love houseplants and I'm really bad at looking after houseplants.
Yeah.
So those two kind of combine.
The existence of my houseplant collection.
It's actually not bad. It's actually a very nice little pot. Yeah. I love that. And so luckily, just I think this sort of, it coincides just enough that I kill plants at the same rate that I can kind of buy them at. So gotcha. It kind of, okay, it's yeah. never quite a sort of jungle. It's like, as I'm throwing one out once a week, I kind of bring one in. And so I'll kind of go around and I'll like often buy some houseplants and I'll go and look outside and look at lawnmowers. I haven't got a garden.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just like to look at the lawnmowers and just, it's really sort of mindful and peaceful. It sounds a bit odd.
No.
I really enjoy it.
I totally understand that because when you're in that environment, I bet you can smell the yeah. smells of it at the moment. That sort of like the soil and the plants themselves yeah. and stuff. There's a really interesting, I've mentioned it so many times in the podcast, it's called Your Brain or Nature. It's actually written by two psychiatrists.
Oh, okay.
And it's basically all about forest bathing. I mean, the Japanese art of forest bathing is called Shirinkanju,
yes.
I think it is. And you're essentially breathing in a lot of the volatile chemicals from the plants themselves that are naturally mood enhancing and anti-inflammatory. There's obviously the environment, the scenery that you're in as well, which is very relaxing. And there have been studies looking at the immune effects as well, like looking at natural killer cells, as well as your heart rate variability and all these different things.
Yeah.
Like actually demonstrate, you know, walking in your park or walking yes. through your do you home
know
there
was, do you know about this really fascinating study? It was done in the 1970s. In, I think it was something like Pennsylvania State University, uh-huh. State Prison, something like this. It's somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And they the way just randomly the way that the prison was built, half of the prisoners on one side looked out onto just literally a brick wall. It was nothing, and on the other half looked out over onto a parkland. And some kind of clever person thought, I wonder what the different rates of mental illness are of the people that have got all their windows looking out onto a brick wall versus yes. onto a park. It's kind of one of those really classic famous. Yes. Sort of studies, and I think there was a guy called Sam Etherington who was this professor, I think he's still alive now, he's still a professor of like general practice and stuff. I think he lives over in East London, and he had this little thing about kind of getting people to do gardening and stuff based on this study because it showed that the people who were looking out on the brick wall had significantly higher rates of mental illness compared to those that were looking out onto the parkland, even while you account for kind of variables like age and so on.
Yeah,
yeah. And like length of prison sentence. Mm-hmm. So there was clearly something about just literally looking out, not even being able to walk in it, but just looking out onto greenery and grass and sort of nature. And so that's kind of how I feel when I go around Saint's home base, because I kind of like, you go outside and there's like all these plants, and I didn't even know a great deal about plants, because I sit there thinking, oh wow, if I had a garden, I'd have this, and maybe I'd do this, and this is what it'd look like. And and it's all, like a little, I don't know, it's very, very sort of meditative. And then I go home with my house plant that I buy. And then I'm thinking it's going to die soon.
I totally get that. And I think that, there are some other studies looking at cognition as well, often looking at an environment, an urban environment on the TV screen and a rural sort of lush green environment, again, on a TV screen. And then they do some IQ-based tests and stuff, and they found that there was that significant difference in that IQ just from that as well. So there's something almost like evolutionary-based in how we are meant to interact with our environment and what impact that can have on our brain function as well. So from the human body illustrated to eating disorders to walking around at home base, I think this is an amazing book. I can't wait for children all over the country to get this, and parents as well. So I really commend you for writing this, and thank you so much for coming in.
Brilliant.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
What a pleasure it was to chat and to cook for Dr. Max. Like I said, you can check out the recipe on the Doctor's Kitchen YouTube channel. Make sure you check out Dr. Max's book. All the socials and links are on thedoctorskitchen.com, and you can find all of this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com. Subscribe to the newsletter for weekly science-based recipes, content, and much more to help you live the healthiest, happiest life. Give us a 5-star rating if you like this pod. It really does help spread the love and the message. Tweet us at doctors_kitchen. Check out Instagram, YouTube, and of course, get a copy of Dr. Max's book, The Marvelous Adventures of Being Human. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.